Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Nachhaltigkeitspodcasts vom Nachhaltigkeitsbüro der HU. Heute wieder mit dem neuesten Vortrag aus unserer Ringvorlesungsreihe Der grüne Faden. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören!
My name is Jörg Niewöhner and I'm currently the director of IRIS Thesis, which is co-hosting this great lecture series. So very happy for you to be here, Hannah. By way of introducing, I wanted to say a couple of things about anthropology because I realize that not everyone is familiar with the discipline as such, probably, because it's not as big and as popular and visible as it is in the US. So essentially, as you will see in a moment from Hannah's presentation and discussion, anthropology studies how people live together. That's probably the shortest form of explaining it. And it studies how people live together at the level of everyday life. And that's why anthropologists go and live with other people, so to speak, what we call participant observation. And they develop this particular mode of ethnography and ethnographic theorizing from this form of social interaction. That's probably the briefest way of looking at it. And as people, most people either live in capitalism, so to speak, or at least their lives are touched by capitalist exchange systems. The capitalism, of course, matters also to anthropology, although oftentimes it's more of a background, I guess, for most social science. It appears as a background, as a stage. It's sort of a presumed social structure. It's an economic form. And then some people focus, of course, on the economy. If you're an economist, I guess that would be true for you. But capitalism in the social science is probably more often object of critical theorizing from a distance than anything else. Now, in Hannah's case, the approach, Hannah Appel's case, I should say, capitalism is treated in a very different way. And that makes it very interesting to us. She calls it treating capitalism as a project, which I guess, and we will hear more about this, really means that she's ethnographically or has and is ethnographically investigating how something that we come to analyze as capitalism is produced and done in specific cases and situations and at specific times. In the case of the book that we're talking about, The Licit Life of Capitalism, or that we're mainly talking about, this place is Equatorial Guinea. So how has Hannah come to do this? Well, she's sort of like a pendulum swung from coast to coast, starting in the US, starting at Yale, and then getting a PhD, receiving a PhD at Stanford in anthropology. And then she spent some time at Columbia and Berkeley and postdocs, and is now an associate professor at UCLA, so University of California, Los Angeles, in the anthropology department. Her work has really centered for more than 10 years around capitalism and its the racialized and gendered inequalities that produces and perpetuates, with a particular focus on the role of industry, private industry, particularly in Africa. You can see the publications, et cetera, extensively on her website. I just want to point out one that we probably won't touch on today, but it's worth reading because it's a great edited volume. The Promise of Infrastructure came out in 2018 together with Nikhil Anand and Akhil Gupta. And I did see that you sent me another link, Hannah, which I hadn't time to to get now. So you feel free to advertise that when you're doing. And the other thing I wanted to point out, because it's also interesting to us, not that we are paying tuition fees, but Hannah is also a member of the Debt Collective, which is a sort of a community organized initiative or union, I guess, demanding the cancellation of, amongst other things, student debt in order to open up universities to, well, non-white people, but also, you know, people, I guess, who are usually disadvantaged by a system that it's hugely expensive and exclusionary for economic reasons in the US. So also a very, very sort of politically active and public anthropologist, may I say. And yeah, we're very pleased to have you here. Thanks for getting up early, so to speak, to speak to us. And looking forward to the discussion. And over to you, Hannah. It's all yours.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. I have to say we have two little kids. So though it is 9 a.m., you know, or 9:20, we have been up for many hours. So it's wonderful to be able to do something at this time. And Jörg, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. And I also just wanted to thank Gretchen and Hannah and Pauline and Axel and everybody who allowed me to be here. You know, it's one of these silver linings that I can speak to you in Berlin from my bedroom in Los Angeles during this otherwise really challenging global time. So what I understand about this series is that I'm going to kind of speak for 15 minutes, and then we're just going to open it up to questions. And there are some people here perhaps who have read different chapters of the book, and so we'll be able to kind of lead us in discussion. So I just thought that I would read a little bit from the introduction of the book, kind of to get us all on the same page, so to speak, also to show a few pictures, which don't really end up in the book. And I'm also going to talk about Equatorial Guinea a little bit, because it's a place that not many people know about on the planet, and it has kind of an unusual colonial history that's important, I think, to share. Okay, so there is the book. I know some of you have read parts of it, but Jörg nicely introduced it. It's called The Licit Life of Capitalism, U.S. Oil in Equatorial Guinea. Dawn in Bata, Equatorial Guinea's second city. At 6 a.m., I stood outside the headquarters of a large U.S.-based oil company with a small group of others, a Spanish woman, a man from Louisiana, and two Equatoguinean men waiting to go offshore by helicopter. We stood quietly and not quite together, separated by the early hour and by not knowing if we were all there for the same purpose. Eventually, an Equatoguinean driver pulled up in a company bus. As we boarded, he requested our identification passes to electronically register each of our exits from the oil compound, and then drove us to the company's private wing of the Bata Airport. After an airport worker searched our bags, we sat in a small room to watch a safety video on the importance of in-flight protective equipment and what to do if our helicopter were to catch fire in mid-air. At liftoff, the helicopter rose effortlessly as the city of Bata spread out beneath us. Further from shore, looking back, the Entem River marked the edge of the African continent. After a while, sights and sounds faded into the calm of the open ocean seen from above and the gently vibrating lull of the helicopter through noise-canceling headphones. Eventually, a bright flame appeared in the distance, attached to a still indistinct industrial atoll, a rig. Just as the rig came into view, so at the moment that I took that photograph, the helicopter banked left to land briefly on what looked like an aircraft carrier, leaving the Spanish woman who you see here on what was in fact a floating production, storage, and offloading vessel, an FPSO. With the production rig still visible some hundreds of yards away across the water, the FPSO, as you can see here, was animated by its own large flare, burning the crude's gaseous byproducts. Both the rig and this self-propelling ship-like structure floated above a field producing 100,000 barrels of crude oil per day. Every 10 days, a tanker would pull alongside this FPSO and leave with 1 million barrels of oil. From subsea hydrocarbon deposits to the rig, to the FPSO, to the tanker, and finally to market, Equatorial Guinea's oil production chain was clearest to me by helicopter, far off the country's shores. Oops. There we go. Capitalism, as Jörg said in the introduction, and as I argue in this book, is not a context, it is a project. And this book offers an ethnographic account of the daily life of capitalism. It is both an account of a specific capitalist project, right? U.S. oil companies working off the shores of Equatorial Guinea, and an exploration of the more general forms and processes, the offshore, contracts, infrastructures, something called the economy, that facilitate diverse capitalist projects around the world. Each of these forms and processes, which organize the book chapter by chapter, is both a condition of possibility for contemporary capitalism and an ongoing entanglement with the raced and gendered histories of colonialism, empire, and white supremacy out of which capitalism and liberalism emerged. And indeed, the book, for those of you who have read parts of it, explores this relationship between the liberal modernity claimed by US oil companies, right? So contractual obligation, market rationality, transparency, and the racialized global inequality that radically delimits the ways in which Equatorial Guinea and other post-colonial African countries might engage with multinational oil companies. Just as racism, patriarchy, and dispossession are not exceptions to liberalism, but constitutive of it, So too, this book argues, informed by the Black radical tradition, that we must shift our understanding of capitalism from one in which markets merely deepen or respond to post-colonial inequality to one in which markets are made by that inequality. In Equatorial Guinea and around the world, accreted histories of racialized disparity proxy for rational, neutral market behavior, the rules of the economy. Global markets, the oil market chief among them, do not merely take advantage of these circumstances, they are constituted by them. This view from the helicopter window, through which Equatorial Guinea itself seems to recede, in which hydrocarbons seem to move effortlessly from one infrastructural node of the commodity chain to another, and where a space referred to by the industry as offshore seems to be a literal watery stage for placeless economic interaction, requires a tremendous amount of work. From manual, managerial, domestic, and political labor to material infrastructures and technologies to the legal, ethical, and affective framing processes required to lubricate the passage of oil and gas to market, the apparent smoothness of the offshore is made and remade in the quotidian project that is hydrocarbon capitalism in Equatorial Guinea. So this view that you're looking at, that we're all looking at here, is redolent with qualities often thought to be intrinsic to capitalism itself: standardization, replicability, technical mastery, the disembedding of economic interaction from social context. But in contrast, the view from 14 months of fieldwork in and around Equatorial Guinea's oil industry demonstrated nothing more than the work required to produce tenuous and contested approximations of those ostensibly intrinsic qualities. And I know that folks aren't as familiar with anthropology here, so what I just articulated is a very common anthropological argument, right? It's a very common anthropological approach to capitalism. Oh, you say capitalism disembeds, let me show you the teeming social world underneath, right? So I'm kind of setting that up, and now I'm going to knock it down a little bit. So given that that's a kind of conventional anthropological approach to these things, which in many ways I agree with, I want to say yes, and yet, the view from the helicopter window is not only misleading, it is also productive. If anthropology often concerns itself with rescuing local specificity and complexity from the abstracting views, distance of views like this one, this book is equally invested in understanding ethnographically, theoretically, politically, what these kinds of views do in the world. These views are not merely wrong in any narrow sense. On the contrary, they are performative in that they generate durable material and semiotic effects in the world. Insofar as anthropology and critical theory approach these abstracting views as fodder for deconstruction, right? So I, the anthropologist with all of my intimate knowledge of local life, can come in and show you contingency, complexity, heterogeneity, or locality within or beneath them, we fail to account for their performative work in the world. We seem to suggest that mere appearances are easily undone by ethnographic intimacy. On the contrary, something widely recognized as global capitalism persists despite that kind of deconstructive work. How? How does that happen? Ethnography can help us follow the work required to create the as-ifs on which capitalism has so long relied: abstraction, decontextualization, standardization. So in this book, I take those as-ifs themselves as ethnographic objects, aspirational project processes, political projects that we can follow in the field. Rather than recovering the complexity and friction effaced by the view from the helicopter window, then, this book accounts for how things come to seem smooth, how the US oil and gas industry works to seem separate, distanced, and outside of local life in Equatorial Guinea. Many of the people with whom I worked in Equatorial Guinea, migrant oil company management in particular, were preoccupied each day with this work of abstraction and distancing: how to make it, how to maintain it, how to ensure that the production and export of oil from Equatorial Guinea might seem detached from local lives, histories, and landscapes. So because this book's analytic trajectory actually follows the US industry's work toward apparent distance and standardization, it is not about Equatorial Guinea in the kind of conventional anthropological sense. And that's why I begin the book with this departure story of sorts, right? The helicopter leaving for Bata toward the offshore, rather than with a kind of anthropological trope that's the arrival story. This is the directionality of sociopolitical life that I explore in the book. And the ways in which this book is and is not about Equatorial Guinea are also choices about a certain kind of ethnographic refusal on the one hand, and an ethnographic insistence on the other. So I'm going to talk very briefly about a wonderful book called Mohawk Interruptus, written by Audra Simpson, who's an anthropologist at Columbia. So like Audra Simpson with the Iroquois, right, an indigenous nation here in the US and Canada, although very differently positioned, myself as a white North American anthropologist, Audra, Professor Simpson is herself Iroquois. I refuse, and I'm going to quote here, the previous practices of discursive containment and pathology that have plagued white textualizations of Equatorial Guinea. I refuse them not only because of their internal flaws, but also because these accounts, as Simpson put it, have teeth, and teeth that bite through time, end quote. So my U.S. oil company interlocutors used white textualizations of Equatorial Guinea and Africa more broadly to justify the violence of their industry's daily practices, from contracts that contravene Equato-Guinean sovereignty to economic theory that locates the reliably grotesque outcomes of oil production solely within the pathological African state. Of course, I'm thinking about resource curse literature here. The industry used anthropology, history, economics, and political science to efface the agency of corporate capitalism and to distance themselves still further from that by which they were surrounded and from which they extracted extraordinary profit. The teeth of knowledge production, right, in Simpson's words, in the mouths of some of our world's most powerful corporations, indeed, bite through time. So this form of ethnographic refusal also contains an ethnographic insistence. If knowing, and if anthropological knowing in particular, has been a mode of power, then this book advocates knowing more about that over which we need more power. It is capitalism, its ideologies and institutions, its people and dreams, its ecologies and erasures, that is my ethnos, right? So that's the ethno and ethnographic. Through that commitment, right, with capitalism as my ethnographic object, I stumbled upon capitalism's intimacy with liberalism, and that too became an ethnographic object. More precisely, I found liberalism in the field, or what Sartori has called vernacular liberalism, and I'm quoting Andrew Sartori here, the movement of liberal concepts beyond the rarefied domains of self-conscious political theory and out into wider worlds. And specifically, the book follows the ways in which oil company management, and to a lesser extent, Equato-Guinean state actors, use law, contracts, economic theory, market rationality, not only as powerful tools in and of themselves, but also as a kind of moral architecture through which to sanction the capitalist practices of oil extraction. Liberalism here, in Beth Pavanelli's words, quote, is not a thing. It is a moving target developed in the European Empire and used to secure power in the contemporary world. It is located nowhere but in its continual citation as the motivating logic and aspiration of dispersed and competing social and cultural experiments, end quote. Both liberalism and capitalism are always made with the things that anthropology has for a long time been so good at capturing, right? Specific people and histories, places and politics, landscapes and livelihoods. And this is no less true in Equatorial Guinea, despite the fact that it is precisely these entanglements that the US oil industry works so hard to sever. And so I'm going to actually just show you a little bit about Equatorial Guinea now. So Equatorial Guinea, which you see in that dot there surrounded by the red square, is a small Spanish-speaking country on the Atlantic coast of Central Africa. And the country itself has three main land masses. So this is Bioko Island, where the capital city is located. You can see that little word Malabo up on the top of the island, and that's where I lived. There's also the mainland and another island called Anobon. And the US-based oil and gas companies in Equatorial Guinea and at the center of the book, for which I use pseudonyms in the book, but if you look up which US oil companies are in Equatorial Guinea, you'll find these names, which is why I share them publicly here, but you can't tell in the book which I'm talking about when, are ExxonMobil, Emirata Hess, recently renamed Hess, Marathon Oil, and actually the UK-based Noble Energy. So these are the companies with whom I've kind of spent the most time. And these maps that you're looking at here look very different from an oil company perspective, right? So Bioko Island, you still see the same map on the right with the red circle around it. And in the oil and gas licensing concession map, you see Bioko Island, right? So the two things in circles are the same island. So these maps look very different from an oil company perspective. Equatorial Guinea's oil industry is offshore, as I said. So here you see Bioko Island surrounded by actual and potential blocks. So spatially delimited areas where subsea hydrocarbon deposits are thought to exist, some of which are already contracted, and you can see those in white or green on the map, and others of which are still available for contract. Equatorial Guinea has an exceptionally brutal colonial and post-colonial history that I won't go into much right now, but you can read about in the book. But suffice it to say that colonialism under Franco's fascist regime sucked. Sorry, that's like a very bad slang term in English, but you know, it was awful. The arbitrary violence that characterized Franco's colonial rule of Equatorial Guinea, so authoritarian dictatorship, military rule, forced labor, radical limitations on movement, rampant executions, also came to characterize post-colonial rule in the country. Equatorial Guinea won independence from Spain in 1968, and the following decade saw one-third of the population either killed or sent into exile. Obiang Nguema Mbazwa, who's a graduate of the Spanish Military Academy at Zaragoza, right, so quite literally trained by Franco's military, was deeply implicated in those early post-independence atrocities, and he eventually took power from the first post-independence leader in 1978. So Obiang, who you're looking at here, took power in 1978, actually the year I was born. After a decade of his military rule, so by the late 1980s, Equatorial Guinea remained bereft of political freedoms and was drowning in multilateral debt. There was a vibrant underground opposition, however, and between 1992 and 1995, Convergencia para la Democracia Social, which is like a convergence for social democracy, an opposition party gained power. And then in 1995, an opposition coalition won the majority in municipal and parliamentary elections. So in other words, nearly two decades after this guy took power, the conjuncture of deep debts and an opposition coalition looked like it might finally unseat his dictatorship, which was at that time nearly 20 years long. And indeed, 1995 was a watershed year in Equatorial Guinea, although not in the way that this opposition electoral victory indicates. That year, the company then called Exxon, so before it merged with Mobil, the company then called Exxon discovered that the Zafiro oil field had production capacities three times greater than the company's entire worldwide output of oil and gas at that time. And then I'm quoting an Equato-Guinean organizer here. The following year, in advance of the presidential election, right, so Obiang was up for election again. In advance of the presidential election, ExxonMobil's petrodollars bankrolled the involvement of a U.S. lobbyist who helped legitimize a rigged contest in which Obiang, this guy, claimed 97.8% of the vote from the same constituency that only months earlier had opted overwhelmingly for the opposition coalition, end quote. Indeed, the Exxon-funded group, which is called ominously the Institute for Democratic Strategies, played a pivotal role in the manufacture of Equatorial Guinea's 1996 election. And that, an opposition member of parliament put it to me succinctly, was when petroleum started. Petroleum, he said, was like a life jacket for the regime, an oxygen balloon to help it float. Obiang Nguema Mbazwa, who you see at the center of this photo, remains in power to this day, and he is now the longest standing political leader in the world. Today, Equatorial Guinea is widely considered to have one of the most corrupt dictatorships in the world. Though the US oil industry's central role in maintaining his dictatorship is rarely acknowledged, the global oil and gas industry is similarly infamous. So how is it that capitalism in its own image, reliably reproduced at the intersection of an industry and a dictatorship that are equally constituted by histories of violence, destruction, and suppression? In Equatorial Guinea and beyond, the oil and gas industry consistently escapes consequential responsibilities for local outcomes, despite profound political, environmental, economic, and social entanglements in each and every supply site. How? How do they do that? This is the puzzle this book seeks to address by focusing ethnographically on what I call, in the title, the licit life of capitalism, right? Licit, not illicit. Licit. So rather than use this book to bring critical attention to the scandals that saturate capitalism's daily life, not least in the oil industry and not least in sub-Saharan Africa, I suggest that oil in Equatorial Guinea counterintuitively offers an ideal place in which to explore what we might take to be the opposite of scandal. Contracts, corporate enclaves, offshore rigs, economic theory. These are the assemblages of liberalism and racialized labor, expertise and technology, gender and spatialized domesticity, which seem to make an industry operating on the edge of legitimacy and legality formally legitimate, legal, and productive of extraordinary profit. This approach to capitalism echoes Saidiya Hartman's approach to the routinized violence of slavery, in which she focuses not on invocations of the shocking or the terrible, but on, quote, those scenes in which terror can hardly be discerned, end quote. This attention to the licit undertakes an anthropology of capitalism that proceeds not from a sociology of error, but from the question of how is it that what currently exists has been stabilized. So for those of you who have seen the book or read some, each chapter, and you see the table of contents here, the offshore, the enclave, the contract, the subcontract, the economy, the political, focuses on one site where the licit life of capitalism is made. So that's just a little bit from the introduction, and I'm going to stop there, and I look forward to hearing questions and discussing with all of you. Thanks so much.